Them they talk about the global village and the market forces. Others they dream of prosperity. With big fat beggars riding happy horses. Then they search for big, big drugs to take the cure diseases caused by small, small bugs. Then they study the sparrow so as to learn more bits and ways to take to design them. Arrow, arrow. Build a bridge across from me to you.
All I wanna do.
Now to feel this space, brothers and sisters, feel this space between me and you.
I got to let you know.
You are beautiful, Lord.
And good morning, everyone, and welcome to Human Rights Radio on 91.3 CJTR, Regina Community Radio. And we're Amnesty International volunteers who are dedicated to the furtherance of human rights at home and around the world. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. I'm Jim Hutchings, and again today I'm joined by co-host Mona Hill.
Hello, everybody. I'm back.
Our special guest today is Ken Ward. He's Resolution's health support worker in the Residential School Support Program at All Nations Hope AIDS Network. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning and Happy New Year. It's good to be here.
Happy New Year, everybody. This is our first show of the new year. It's exciting. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little bio on Ken Ward, who hails from the community of Enoch Cree Nation in Alberta. Quite an accomplished fellow from this. Looks very interesting. Your past accomplishments have contributed to the formation of the Feather of Hope Society Aboriginal AIDS Prevention in Alberta, Southern Aboriginal Working Group, and you've been in Calgary. You are an advisor for All Nations Hope AIDS Network in Saskatchewan, and the formation of the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network Canada. So you were... Sounds like on the bottom floor of that, or on the ground floor of the creation of CAN, eh?
Oh, yes, one of the old pioneers back then.
Right, wonderful. Ken's also a contributor for the Aboriginal National Tabloid, The Windspeaker. I've read some of those publications. They're great. Good stuff in them. Another interesting thing that we're going to find out about, but not today, but next month when we have Ken back, is about the 14 documentaries that he's worked on, and the most requested to this date is National Film Board's production, The Long Walk. Ken was a former band counselor for his reserve in 1995, and he's also worked in consultation in all three provinces in the West, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and BC, in the correctional system for the last 20 years. In March of 1990, Ken went public with his diagnosis of HIV from a dirty needle and thus became the first Native to reveal his diagnosis to the mainstream in Canada and bring the issues forward to the Aboriginal population of putting a face to the race. Today, what we want to talk about, however, is the work that Ken is doing for the Health Resolution Support Program with All Nations Hope AIDS Network. If you want to give us like a couple of minutes, just sort of a perspective on what you're actually doing in this role, I think it's very important.
Well, this role is definitely important. Basically, our primary objectives are to provide emotional support and moral support for what has been called the survivors who've been through the residential school from the abuses, be it sexually or physically abused. What we do is we send notices that there are hearings coming up here in Regina, and the individuals themselves or their families who are attending are here to attend the hearing. And it's not in a court setting. It's more of a safe environment that could be held in one of the hotels that could be set and is usually for about a day or so. Basically, what we do is we're not lawyers. We're just there to provide that support where it's really crucial, especially if individuals who do not have any other family support or choose not to have family there because of sensitivity issues. So basically, we will introduce ourselves as part of the process. Go in and say, hi, this is who we are, and we're here for you. And they go, if we ask them if you need us, if you don't, we'll still sit here. We have four on the team right now through All Nations Hope, and we have additional now who has just been hired on through RAMP. And what we do, the team is consisted of two workers, that's Selena and myself, and then two elders. We have Viola and Gordon. So basically, we're a team, and we're there just to ensure that you're not alone.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I think this could be a very lonely thing to have to do.
It's definitely, whether it's a lonely one for the ones who have been through it to share their testimony, because
exactly.
It's their day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they finish the day of the hearings, it may last for another day.
Right.
But a lot of the memories and the scars of history of the abuses will be triggered.
Right.
And so it's so, so important to be able to acknowledge them and saying we respect that space, but we're here.
Right.
Because the concern is that there could be some who may go home and don't have that support mechanism in place for themselves in the community because they shared something that was very, very painful. Where did they go for the support?
Right. And on that note, I think that's a good segue for me to insert a personal experience that I had 2 years ago. When some of the residential school payments were coming out from the federal government, I was in a particular job where I was in constant daily contact with people who were survivors, who have been survivors of the residential school system and of that abuse. And I realized at that time that I, because it wasn't part of my past or my history, perhaps not the best equipped person to be able to deal with this other than listening and giving them whatever support I could. So at that time, I'm going to read a letter, actually, that I wrote. And I wrote this to Mr. Peter McCallum, who was working with community-based programs for the Saskatchewan region of First Nation and Inuit health programs. And this is a letter I wrote based on the research that I did, trying to find support for the people that I was working with who had come to me and said, I'm a survivor of residential schools. I need help. And I know this, you know, the government decided that they were going to make payments to people. People had to fill out application forms. You talked a few minutes ago about the emotional trauma. Post-traumatic stress is well known and a serious issue, and this I was experiencing this with the people I was working with to a great degree because of these payments coming out and because everything was being brought out to the forefront and in public. So this is the letter I wrote. It says, Dear Peter, I had called him on the phone and he had asked me to please write this out and send it to him. So pursuant to our phone conversation, I'm writing to apprise you of a problem encountered by myself when attempting to access the Indian Residential School Resolution Health Support Program as per a Health Canada Regional Coordinator Directory. My brief background to my role and work with First Nations people in Saskatchewan was that I am a social worker, and I won't go into where I was working at the time, but I was providing resource support to my clients, and I was providing personal one-on-one counseling to the residents where I worked and families of the residents when they needed help. It has been my experience in the past 6 months that a good number of my clients whom I have helped to fill out common experience payment applications, as well as some who have come to me for counseling, have requested help to be able to articulate and receive counseling regarding their past experiences in residential schools. As this experience has not been a part of my life, I felt it expedient to find appropriate counseling services within Regina and South Saskatchewan, particularly for First Nations people living in urban areas. I began my search within the city and expanded to treatment and counseling centers in various southern regions. It became quickly apparent that there are no specific counseling services available in southern Saskatchewan for survivors of the Indian residential school experience. This was back in January 2008, so we're talking mm-hmm. 2 years ago exactly. It was at this time that I approached a First Nations employee and counselor of a local First Nation family service with whom I share some clients. We, at that time, created a proposal targeting the above issue, and then I went on to say, today I was given a package that included information about accessing the Indian Residential School Resolution Health Support Program as per Health Canada Regional Coordinator Directory. The pamphlet includes information of availability of 1. Professional counseling, 2. Emotional support, 3. Cultural support, 4. Transportation, and 5. Appeals. This sounds wonderful. I was really excited about this. I then decided to call the phone number listed for the Saskatchewan region, and that was INAC at 1920 Broad Street in Regina. And I've written the number down here. I was quite interested in discovering how to access the services listed so as to be able to better serve my own clients. When I called, here, and this is the process I went through calling this from my office. When I called, I was redirected by an operator to call another number. Thankfully, I was not at a payphone with only a quarter in my pocket and in a personal crisis situation. I called the number and was transferred to the new number, replacing the old number. So this now was the third number. I discovered that the gentleman who answered the phone was only able to offer me more phone numbers depending on my needs. I discussed my reason for calling, that I was attempting to find out what type of counseling was available and at what location in South Saskatchewan it could be found. I was directed to call yet another number, the Indian Residential School Crisis Line. I was advised that it was the only available counseling service, and that this gentleman I was speaking to was in Waterloo, Ontario, not Saskatchewan. He did not have any information as to where to physically go for counseling. I called the crisis line. The counselor on the crisis line advised me that she was aware there was a problem with phone numbers, and that the line was not the least bit adequate for the needs of a great number of the people who had been calling the line. When I asked her for a phone number of someone whom I could access that could give me answers as to where to find ongoing personal counseling, she gave me the original number I called. And this took place over the course of about a half an hour. This is the original number that was in the brochure that had been changed and sent me on a wild goose chase throughout the system. I have to cough. I'm getting over a cold. One moment. Sorry. Thankfully, I'm not a First Nation person who was looking for help to find counseling in Regina or South Saskatchewan other than suicide and crisis intervention, which is available. Thankfully, I'm not living in poverty without a telephone of my own and no more money for the payphone. Thankfully, I'm not a person with disabilities or language problems or literacy challenges that prevents me from attempting to navigate this insane, totally useless, and practically inaccessible program that has been created by bureaucratic systems in a feeble attempt to placate the public into believing there is actually serious long-term individual counseling services available to First Nations Indian residential school survivors who want to access those services. Another issue that needs to be addressed immediately is the crisis hotline hours of operation. We need to have 24-hour service available to anyone who is in crisis. Crisis does not wait to occur until regular working hours in Ottawa time zones. Due to my experience, I strongly recommend that Health Canada provide the opportunity for one-on-one in-person counseling and family counseling to all First Nations people who request aid regarding their IRS experiences and daily living challenges, no matter what income level, what disability. Some people do not do well at all talking on the telephone, what first language is spoken, or where they reside. There is an immediate need for this service in Saskatchewan. So that was my letter to Peter McCallum after my experience of just trying to access a crisis line for Indian residential school survivors. That I received a reply from this. I actually got a phone call from Peter McCallum with great understanding that there were problems. And at that time, they were planning a network meeting January 23rd to 24th of 2008 in Saskatoon, and he invited me to go to this meeting to talk about this problem. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend the meeting. So that's my history with this, and since that time, of course, I have friends, even personal friends, whose families have encountered these problems as well. So I'm going to turn it over to you now, and you can respond to this. I'm sure you'll have a response to this. But what thrills me the most, and the reason why I really wanted to talk about this today, is to see that it's not just the government is not the only place that survivors and families of survivors can go for help.
Oh, yeah.
Take it away.
Gosh. Happy New Year, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, since 2008, and I guess for me it's not to speak on behalf of Peter, but I've right. known Peter from years before, but when this whole initiative came together and we're talking about the support program, one of the biggest things is that what happened was this prairie wildfires came out when the announcement of the money that was going to be distributed. Unfortunately, it's like putting the cart before the horse, though. And I'm one of those who went through the rescue myself, and when we heard about it in my reserve, oh my gosh, you know, there was wildfire, there was things, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, there's going to be the common experience payment that's going to be coming out. You made this announcement, but folks, it's not the money thing, but what are you doing to take care of yourself in the process? Because there's going to be a lot of emotion, there's a lot of triggers from this. Because, again, if some are still struggling with addictions or abuse, and a lot of this, the violence that's going on, and then is this going to contribute to more harms to our society, to our peoples? So where's the support place intact when that announcement was made and that was going to be distributed? So back home in Alberta, I had concerns about it. And the same thing when I worked out in Vancouver as a support worker. And I did a short contract work with Healing Our Spirit prior when the money was coming out with CEP. We had big fears of frontliners. The money's coming out, but what do we have, you guys? Do you have a job description for us workers? Are we clear? Do we know what we're mandated to do and what we can do and provide services? That was some of our concerns, because once you get this money, bang, it's going to create more of a spiral, of people who are going through the claims, and we're going to have more suicides. We're going to have more violence out there. Yeah. So what exactly?
Let me interject and ask this question. Why would we have more suicides? Because we're getting money.
There's fear. Right now, we are still experiencing that, even with our IAP claims.
Is IAP stand?
Independent assessment programs, distribution of dollars. These are the ones specifically with the hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go see an educator, an adjudicator, to go through this process of claiming the bigger chunk for the ones who's been victimized from physical and sexual abuse. So the IEP claim is a lot more monies are being distributed.
Right.
So the thing is going back to what you're saying about sending a letter out and expressing that concern to Peter, that is legitimate. I will have to, say I appreciate that, simply because if somebody's out there has some concerns and saying, hey, look, here's the picture that I'm experiencing. You're not the only one. You know, there's been others who have saying, gosh, who do I call? And then when you go full circle and you're back to that same one, we lose people through the cracks.
Of course.
So obviously, in having to listen to Peter of the history, a bit of the how did this all come together, it was then with Health Canada, and Peter, Mr. McCollum, and a few others got together from the regions, from the respective provinces, said, hey, we've got a problem here. We've got to really look at the big picture here.
I was very pleased with Peter's response when I talked to him.
Yeah, he is really receptive I found.
Yes.
And we're still in the process of grooming the program itself.
Mm-hmm.
And alternative support, we always encourage this. One of the biggest things is when you're going through your IAP claim forms, the ones who are going from the abuses, from sexual and physical abuse, we really encourage, this is what I'm finding, from what we learned from the past with CEP, but what we're learning now, it's important that when you're filling out this big document, it's like writing your autobiography, it's intimidating, it's overwhelming.
Of course it is.
Because you have to have the specifics of who hurt you, who raped you, who beat you, and names and places and try to be specific. And it's like, my gosh, we've got 50, 60, 70-year-olds who are trying to regurgitate the scars of the past of the pain when we're talking about trauma. So all of a sudden, you're sitting there with this document and you're focusing on that, and then all of a sudden, the pain comes out, the hurt comes out. And you don't want to share it with family members because you're ashamed, because there's living in shame. So what happens to the individual who carries this? So for me, what we really stress and what we're learning, it's still a learning process to be able to encourage people when you get that, if you choose to do it alone, but that's fine, but debrief and share with somebody that you can honestly trust. If you can't find that suicide hotline, but if you have the resources, it's most important for form filling of the IEP claims. Get that support. Find that sense of balance in the sense of what is it that you need, be it whether if you're Christian, whether if you're cultural or religious in your own set, or find those support structures you can be able to vent it out. And once you're finished completing that form and you send it out and you're working with one of my peer workers that were located in different zones or regions, find that individual and to be able to go through a process and establish some kind of support mechanism. Because majority of us people who are in this position as resolution health support workers have been through it. So we have that sense of understanding.
I think that's key.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my process of searching, was because I hadn't been. It wasn't a personal issue for me at all.
Yeah.
Other than absorbing the people that I care about, absorbing the things that they were telling me. So
ideally, what would have been really helpful if there were some key people who, back then in 2008, mm-hmm.
yeah.
was to be able to find other people in your agency or who has been through the rescue, seems somewhat balanced a lot more, that they can peer support,
right.
develop some
which
kind of...
Which was my outreach to an Aboriginal agency at that time. Yeah.
And that was a good stepping stone.
Yeah.
It probably helped that agency to recognize, hey, there is a need here as well.
Right.
So,
right. It's sort of the forefront of all this. Let's get into a little bit more detail. I think it's very important for our listeners to understand some of the minute detail of what happens to someone who has been through this physical trauma, the emotional trauma, spiritual, and then at some point in their life, in order to feel that they're being listened to, in order to feel that they're worthwhile receiving money, which I have, maybe I've had a problem with too at times,
mm-hmm.
unless you can tell us all the details and we can put you inside of a little box, your experiences, and put a number on that box, because I'm aware, I think that's how the process was, and I wouldn't mind if you explain that process also, then your experiences maybe not be validated, maybe not valid enough for us. And what happens to someone? So do you want to just speak to that sort of thing and start maybe with the process for filling out these forms and what people are expected to do and what they're expected to answer and the ramifications personally and socially?
Okay. Well, we'll go through that. To go through the process itself, you've got about maybe, I'd say, 30 pages of the IEP. And when you look at the questions, they're going to ask you to be very specific and detailed as much as possible. They really want to emphasize on who were the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
Identify who the persons are. If possible, what, and also share what type of experiences, and that can get really graphic.
Right.
And so it's easier to put it on paper, but it's a real challenge to keep that thought, because it's going to trigger many other thoughts from the past, right? So what happens is, once you go through that whole form filling, you're writing your story.
This almost sounds like being on trial and having to repeat your story, and having a prosecutor say, well, tell us what happened. And I'm sorry to state it like this, but that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, well, it's the... it's in a similar sense, it is a trial. It is a hearing, but it's not in a court setting. We're not, we try to keep that away as possible. They do anyway.
Yeah.
So who you have sitting around the table, you could have a church rep, or also you could have your family or an elder primarily. In most cases, elders are invited, RSWs ourselves, but also the representative who, from Health Canada, that could be there, your lawyer, as well as the educator. So you've got a little group of people sitting around a table in a hotel.
And through your support work, you would possibly give support to someone who has no idea how to go about getting a lawyer even.
Well,
that
that's
be part
just
of your role as well?
Yeah. We can only provide a list. We can't refer to certain lawyers because that's not our business.
Okay.
We say, this is what we got. We got an update. And we also, what's really helpful is that, you know, if you're First Nations as well, you're covered with costs that could be included with mental health therapists.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So we've got upgraded revamp list of mental health therapists who are available, and that's covered by FNIB as well. So so it's getting these key resources in place and saying, okay, you know. And most times when people go through the hearings or go through the whole process of the hearing, the form filling, but the hearings itself, and if there's an aftercare program or a future care program, that what it's now being called, through word of mouth somehow, because you could have maybe 15 to 20 people, individuals from a certain reserve, they'll somehow connect with each other and say, you know, that's a good lawyer. So, you know, we allow that. That's their choice.
Is there financial support for legal advice? Is that money expected to come out of any money received back from the government by the claimant?
Yeah, what happens is that the understanding or the agreement is that the 15% will be covered through the Health Canada.
15% of the legal cost.
Yeah, legal cost, and then there will be another 15. Normally it would be 15. Some lawyers haven't even charged.
Wow.
You know, and those are the ones who
that's
really...
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Wow, it says a lot. The poor lawyers, the things that they hear about themselves. That's a wonderful thing to hear, that some of them have been sensitive enough to help out like that.
From my experience, there are some genuine lawyers out there who are... We have to consider them as well, who are, have heard the stories of their clients. And tell you, I've seen some lawyers who've just been impacted by the stories. So it's quite an emotional ride.
Yeah. How much time do we have, Jim, before the break?
Oh, got about a minute.
Okay. All right. I think what we're going to do is we're going to continue this conversation after the break. This is very emotionally charged, this conversation. I want to give people that have been listening to the show so far a chance to think about what we've been hearing, and sort of try and understand what's been going on so far about coming to a commission and coming to these hearings and having to talk about the personal experiences that you've had in your life. Most people who are physically, sexually, emotionally abused in their lives and neglected in their lives don't generally talk about these things in public. This is not something the average person talks about.
Mm-hmm.
This is a different situation altogether. You know, it's something that Aboriginal people are going through. The average person who is not Aboriginal will never have to go through in their lives at all. I mean, you may be talking about receiving money here, but this is sort of that's such a minute detail compared to having to speak about this in public. So let's head to the break, and we'll talk about more on the way back. And we are back, and I'm Mona Hill. And this is Jim Hutchings with Amnesty International, and we're on Human Rights Radio on CJTR. And our guest today is Ken Ward from the community of Enoch Cree Nation in Alberta, who is currently working with All Nations Hope AIDS Network in Regina as a health resolution support worker. And that is in regards to the residential school support program. Ken, you work with a team of four workers, which are two workers and two elders, right?
Yeah.
And your primary objective is to provide emotional and moral support to survivors of residential schools who have been abused sexually or physically, and those who are attending the hearings being held in Regina. When is that happening?
The hearings itself?
Yeah.
Oh, they started already.
Okay.
Yeah. We've been...
I know that this has sort of been going across the country.
Yeah.
When did it start in Regina?
Here we were hired on about 6 months ago.
Okay.
I came in July.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where are the hearings being held?
They can be situated in any of the hotels.
Okay.
Here in Regina.
All right.
Yeah.
So if a person decides I would like to go to this hearing and have my story heard and testify about my treatment, how do they create that opportunity to do so?
The process is you fill out the claim form, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. IAP claim form. And once you finish documenting all your stuff, you forward it to, and it'll be sent to, and if you get a lawyer, which would be helpful in most times, to get a lawyer, that they would do most of the paperwork and
right.
do the research for you. So what you do, you're just there to share your story, document it, pass it on to the lawyer. The lawyer will carry it on to the next level, which would be brought to setting up some hearing dates.
Okay.
It may not happen so quickly. It will take a while because lawyers have to get their business done as well.
We're talking a matter of months, perhaps?
Oh, heck yeah. I'm going through mine right now.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in Surrey at the time, and that was about 5 years ago. So I went through my forms and sent it and found a lawyer that's based in BC, even though I was brought up in res school in Alberta. But the thing is, they need to get a lot of the information, such as your data, all your personal stuff, because my hospital records, and even if I was a juvenile delinquent, even though they won't have the rap sheets or anything, but anything that's pertinent and that's related to the abuse as well.
Right.
So. Once you get, they get all that together, they send it to get it all finalized and to come up with a date. And then normally a lawyer will notify you appropriately and say, hey, most times we'd have people living in the city and, getting a hotel and stuff that wouldn't be necessary. But for those who are living out of town, would come in to pay for their travel. So you need to make arrangements for that.
I see.
But we don't pay for it. It'll be covered as part of the expenses.
Okay.
So, and then the hearing actually happens.
And do they bring in a number of people to spend, like, perhaps a whole day listening to stories?
No, it's very intimate.
One-on-one?
It's very intimate.
Okay.
Like the setting in the hearing. You have the say. The individual, the claimant, has to say whether if they want a church rep there as well, whether they want a worker like myself there,
mm-hmm.
or family members. They're the ones who should be empowered to be able to make some choices because it's their day, like
right.
I emphasized.
Right.
Because you're going to be talking and sharing a lot of this stuff that you need to feel safe, you need to feel comfortable to go through the process of the actual regurgitating what you've written
right.
on your form. You need to be able to feel that, that sense that if you bring a lot of people around there, you're going to get really distracted.
Right.
So ideally, it's nice to keep it minimal, keep it
right.
to close-knit.
Right. Okay. What are the benefits of being able to do this? Being able to bring forth your story and speak about it publicly, even though it is an intimate setting. What are the benefits of that, Ken?
Part of it is, I think, well, I know if you're sharing your story, and I'm coming from my own personal experience from having to do that and doing workshops years ago, but the most important thing that is to be able to let go, to be able to say, this is what happened, this is me, to be able to look at the part of the healing process, to be able, if you haven't shared your story before, now is your time,
mm-hmm.
because if you... Ask the individual has to ask him, is the money the motivator to look at forgiveness, or is it me sharing my story of seeking that process of forgiveness so I can get on with my life?
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, that would be my dream, is to be able to know that the survivors or the claimants to go through this process, knowing that it's part of the healing process. That's the number one goal.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. What's the downside?
Downside... And it has happened in some situations is that it's like putting this whole thing, and I really felt uncomfortable when I heard it. And I'm going to try to paint a picture here for your listeners as well as with you. That when we had these truth and reconciliation forums, people can go to the larger cities where it's designated, come and share your story, we need to document it. Well, I know of some people and some elders in my reserve wanted to go, but listen, but they've been through the rescue, but they didn't want to share because their fear is if I say my heart out at this gathering, at this forum, in a big forum,
right,
I'm opening up who I am. And trust is a big issue amongst our peoples because we've been violated and we've been abandoned by that word for so many years. So to come back home and say, I spilled my guts, but when you come back home, who's there to catch that pain?
Well, especially if you're an elder and you're supposed to be there for everybody else.
Exactly.
Who's there for you?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, part of the downfalls is looking at who's going to catch you when you fall. You know, mm-hmm. when you leave there.
And you're supposed to be the strong one.
You're supposed to be the
right?
strong one. Yeah.
And going through a second trauma of having of relating your story
yeah.
and relating your abuse and your trauma can also trigger negative consequences.
We've had
personally,
some,
right?
We've had some suicides.
Some of those are pretty bad.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
I was privy to someone very close to me whose relative received her first check. And basically left a note with the check that said, so now this is what my life is worth. And mm-hmm. she hung herself.
Yeah.
And this is a true story.
And yeah. it so happens. And there's a fear because once you get a, you look at triggering the pain, but also you're looking at still feeling alone.
Right.
Money does not heal.
Right.
And I hear that often. Even the elder I work with, once you get that check, it's not over. You know, some people
no.
say
it, and sometimes it's just the beginning
exactly
of a new, of something new.
Exactly. Some yeah. of the there's a couple of them I've heard after their hearing and saying, "Is this it for me?
Yeah,
is that
all over?"
And, yeah, and that was the biggest fear. And this is, and it's good to have the elders there, especially when I hear Gordon speak mm-hmm. to them, and say, you know, it's not over. It's not done yet. Your journey, like you said, it's just begun.
Right, a journey of healing. And I'm sure a lot of people have done quite a bit of healing before this has begun
yeah.
in order to carry on and be successful in their lives, because many have been.
Oh, yeah.
But to bring that all back up again is not always something that's, you know, a positive thing.
You can never put closure.
Right.
I think a lot of our people, including myself, can never put a closure to that and saying, yes, I too was abused, because amongst my siblings, there were six of us who went to Blue Quill School. And we had some people, even though I may not look Native, but you think I'd be treated different and spoiled and pampered because, well, he's blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white-skinned kid here. But we were the, for my siblings still had told me, I was between 5 and 7 years old, but I was the one who was mostly abused in the school.
Wow.
So the thing was is that what was really important is, you know, having to carry all that pain and the trauma as well. And growing up and how it's contributed to my life and where I'm at. And I think the biggest thing is that we need to emphasize, and we've said this even prior to when the claims were coming out, that I've been to so many wellness conferences, Moccasin Country out here in South Saskatchewan, but forgiveness is one of the key essential ingredients for survival after all of this. Most of all, forgive yourself before you can forgive others.
We self-blame?
Yeah. So we look at that. The other part of what's really critical and crucial is looking with our kids, survivors, children of survivors. And there's a phrase they use, intergenerational families.
Right.
So the biggest thing was is that we need to bridge the gap and work it from a family perspective as part of the healing process.
Right.
Because some of these people who go through the claims are still keeping the silence within themselves. You know, they're going, sharing at the hearing, but when they come home, some of the, you know, they're still not
safe. They still haven't talked about it in their family.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So there still needs to be a process.
Yeah.
After they say 2013, supposedly that the claims are going to be shut down for IAP, that'll be it. You know, and our argument is that's not going to finish. That,
right.
You can't set a date and say, okay, you know, the funding is no longer there, or you're
sometimes that's a huge challenge
for
those in the helping professions, is government funding being just, you know, short term, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You mentioned the term intergenerational earlier, And we see the consequences of grandparents being raised in residential school and not and away from their own families, away from their own mothers and fathers and uncles and aunties, and not being taught parenting skills and loving, caring, and you know skills to pass on to their children. And we see that, I see that in a lot of the grandchildren that I know today.
And this is what contributes. Is a majority of the part of the problem that we have in our communities on the reserve level as well, is that contributes to the gang problem, the violence, the addictions, you know, mm-hmm. lack of family planning or parenting,
right.
Even our culture and our identity, mm-hmm. you know, a sense of belonging. So a large part of that, when the Red School first came in, about you know. Many, you know, I think it was out in 19, I got some records here. But when it first came in, it really tore apart the family, including my own,
mm-hmm.
you know. So once that had an impact back then, as Indian people, we were visionaries. We had that gift to be able to understand the vision of a family or where you're going to be in 10 years. But today, we don't have that as much. It's more chaotic. You're just surviving from day to day. So where did it all stem from? So the Red School definitely has played and contributed to a lot of our broken families and our broken circles, you know, in our families. And, of course, it destroyed communities. We know that. We acknowledge that. And the most important thing is, and I apply this for myself, if I'm going to survive, even living with HIV for so many years after being an addict who, you know, Jack rigs my arms, well, I want to live for a change, but what does that mean? It seems foreign. That means I have to start trusting all over again. That means I have to start looking at my own needs in terms of respecting. If I can't respect society itself, society owes me nothing. As far as I'm concerned, I made my peace with that. I owe it to myself. So if I'm going to respect society, I need to respect myself first as well. So if I'm going to be, you know, contribute to society, then I need to feel a sense of, okay, I've made my peace. You know, am I healed? No. I probably won't heal till the end I die, realistically. We never stop healing each day. But with the residential school, how it's impacted us from the individual to the family to the community, we need to all do it together. We talked about it in Moccasin Country years ago about keeping that circle strong. Well, we need to honor that today within our own communities as well. You know, not only with mainstream society.
Mm-hmm.
So the only one who's going to start that campfire before you get the sweat lodge going is it takes one person, but it also needs more to keep the fires burning. So, and then, you know, your sense of wellness is on its way when you have a good sweat.
Right on. Which is such a positive thing.
Well, we have to.
A positive experience. And let's talk a little bit more now about the positive outcomes of having the commission, the positive outcomes of the various facets of being able to speak publicly and being able to tell your story, and money as well, because money is important. I mean, it's obviously not the be-all and end-all, but it has created wonderful opportunities for a lot of people as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, some of the things I hear that are good note is some people spend their money well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure, they're starting to think about, gosh, what did I learn from this? Bottom line from my experience. Now, what do I need to change, or what do I need a life. I need a future. This can help me. May not be able to buy that mansion, but I think they could be able to buy a little home for somebody or for their kids or their grandchildren, so they won't be homeless, so they can afford to be able to do that. You know, some people think, the most, you know, claims can range from 30 to maybe over 200 grand,
mm-hmm.
right? For the ones who are the most severe. But the majority I've heard some positive about it, people spent it well. Even with the CEP, there has been people who have been wise about it because they've learned from this. The most important thing is that anything is learning about we're learning about how to budget again. You know, I think everybody has that. But some people have kind of sit down and say, this is what I expect. And we encourage them. We don't tell people how to spend your money.
It's not easy to budget when you've been living in poverty all your life and you don't have really anything to budget with.
Oh, definitely. You know,
when you're speaking of budgeting, you're talking about using your money wisely. If you have very little money, it's not something you really think about. You use what you have to survive.
Well, exactly. So when you get a little bit of chunk of change in your pocket, in your wallet, in your bank account, it's kind of like, gosh, I want to spend it all. I want to have fun with it.
Yeah.
But, okay, what does that mean by having fun? Number one, the only ones I would be concerned about are the ones who are struggling with addictions or families who are codependent. Then that becomes a critical issue.
It has been critical for many people.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why some people are afraid when they get the settlement that they're going to be bombarded, you know, by people who want just, well, you know, come on, you owe me.
Right.
Sort of thing.
I'm your brother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's important to be wise about it. And that's what I would only hope to encourage people, if it's not only with residential school claim money, but oil money distributions or land claims. Folks, if you want to be re-victimized or be subject to predatory people who want to see you as, you know, as you got that money in your pocket, or to the other end, you know, look at yourself.
You know, it's interesting you should bring up the predatory people, because when this money started coming out, I actually saw advertisements in the newspapers from small companies, corporations, even like car sales places, saying, you know, we take residential money for a vehicle, something similar to that. And I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned by that.
Oh, yeah. When I was out in Vancouver and when we started this whole thing, came, I was afraid because we had these, you know, companies. Well, here, you know, we'll lend you some money.
We'll lend you some money till you get your check.
Yeah, and just sign this piece of paper.
Right.
You know, and
that's,
you don't see the fine writing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, geez, I just sold my land again for $5 here. Just because I need, I need syrup. I need sugar.
So people
have to be, at this day in age, there needs to be a lot more awareness, but there also needs to be a lot more education. Number one, make sure you have a solid support structure.
And that includes a lawyer.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Get that team together. Get that understanding of who's in. You're going to have to start trusting each other again, folks. Yes, I've been abused from the rest school. Yes, I've been raped when I was 13 by an older guy. You know, I've been a ward of the government, and I trusted the system. I had no choice. But we're talking about my own experience of trusting and having to rebuild that. Once I was told I was diagnosed, I was going to die from 6 months or 10 years. That was in 89. Mm-hmm. I knew I had to make changes. Number one was looking at my past. Number two is learning how to let go of the past but accepting it.
Yeah.
And number three is how to survive. Okay, so yeah, the Red School had contributed a lot to my harms of as a kid and as a teenager, going through the process as well as being a ward of the government and my whole experience of the trauma I went through. So it's a matter of anybody who's going to survive through all of this is that you have to have a solid game plan. Support, support, support.
Right.
And open the doors and start learning to trust again. And that's why we're there as RHSW workers. We are part of that process. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud because I see some people who went through their hearings. I'm so proud of them because their life and their balance because they got that support mechanism in place.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is make sure that you have a sound and financial kind of budget or way to ensure that you won't be intimidated or harassed by anybody who wants you and to be victimized at. And number three, get a will. Make sure you have a will. You may be young, but you never know. Simply because if you don't have a will, you have an individual and this happens, will pass away prior to the hearings. And where does the money go? And so families are fighting with each other. Well, who takes claim for that?
So if you pass on before you've had a chance to testify at the hearings, you're still eligible for the money.
If you got a trustee.
Okay.
So if you have somebody that you identify and is documented, as well as that if the monies are going to be distributed, that trustee is responsible. But you got to have a will in place, no matter who it is. I got a will in place, and I'm still
should have a will.
Well, no definitely. But it's creating more family dissension and battles within the family circle. So again, you're just kind of snowballing and nothing's resolved.
Yeah.
It becomes a money issue now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the third thing.
get the will out and ensure that you've got all your bases covered. If you have anything that you need to do, give us a call. We're all based in Saskatchewan.
And how would people get in touch with you?
Oh, you can catch me at Tim Hortons on 5th. No, I'm just kidding.
Does your boss know that?
When we set up support meetings, or they call me one-on-one, I'll go anywhere that's comfortable for them. You know, I don't have to be necessarily based in the office. So.
Absolutely.
But we do have numbers at All Nations Hope, and you can reach me. I'm one of the persons. I can give you my number if you need that. Mm-hmm. I'll leave my card with you.
Sure.
And but again, there's 4 of us.
Wonderful.
Well, you're welcome. Wonderful.
Are there any other First Nation agencies in Regina itself that are doing the work that you're doing, or is this basically a program from All Nations Hope?
No, we've got a new group on board because Regina is one of the larger base populations who hasn't gone through their claim forms, even with the CEP claim forms, really, because of our population base.
Okay.
So we've got RAMP.
Okay.
Who's now on board?
And what's RAMP? Just for those listeners who don't know,
that's the Regina Alternative Measures Program.
Okay.
And so give them a call as well.
Okay.
And but like I say, we need to. My fear is concern is that for those people who really need to seriously think about doing their IAPs, don't wait till the last minute, because once a deadline comes in, you're going to be rushed, and you can't afford to rush.
And is that something you want to rush through at all?
Oh, gosh, no. It takes time.
Right.
It's got to take time.
Right.
Yeah.
So that sounds like your words of advice for anyone out there. What are your last words of advice for those who are not First Nation, who have not had an understanding of all of these issues? What have you got to say to us?
You know, I found that in mainstream society, non-Aboriginal, but I really, really appreciate the people who are very understand, taking the time to understand what we go through. And I think the most important thing that we as mainstream society is that we need to learn how to trust and re-engage on the trusting again and respecting each other.
And that's, I was going to say that's a mutual thing.
Yeah. Because we've been so lost for so many years. You know, we're the lost peoples because of the impact of this legacy. And for me, if I'm going to find some sense of truth and reconciliation, once again, I need to do it within myself and then to society and saying, okay, folks, you know, if we're going to improve the quality of living and life within our amongst people as a whole, and here in Regina, we need to be able to strengthen that bond of respect. And you know, in return, I have seen a lot of people who may not understand the residential, the legacy, but taking that time just to hear our stories is the best thing to do.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Ken Moore with All Nations Hope, Residential School Survivor Support Worker.
Hey.
Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here with you all.
Take it away, Jim.
Okay, Amy. And we're just about out of time, so my usual closing. Peter Benenson, Amnesty International founder, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."